Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
What form is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
And I said, I want to win the league, but I want to win it better. You can understand that, can't you?
Yes.
Good lad.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
It's Monday, it's the start of the working week for many of you, so I suppose I should just start the show with some good news. The second captain's Rugby World Cup panic button, henceforth to be known as the Owen McDevitt Rugby World Cup panic button, has been permanently put beyond use. It's been decommissioned, Ken. It's been successfully defused. It is an X panic button. Welcome to the second captain's podcast. Hello there, Ken.
Hello there, Ken. So you've taken advantage of Owen's absence to go to work on his legacy.
I have. I'm taking it apart piece by piece, and I've started with what some would call a populist move. I take out the most annoying thing that he's ever brought into this show.
Okay.
Other slightly more popular items may follow in the coming days.
They look like giants to you. That's the...
Yeah, big man.
Hey there, Simon. How are you?
Hey, how's it going?
Ireland's 19-10 win over Wales in the Aviva on Saturday. Might not have been perfect, might not even have been all that commanding, but there were enough positives to send us off to Japan in a good mood. We're back, baby.
The previous game I scored a new Irish record, 19 points. I was gobsmacked.
That's still, by multiples, less annoying than the panic button, but that's still pretty annoying. We're now just 11 days from the opening match of the Rugby World Cup. We have an All-Ireland football final replay to look forward to, and Ireland are inching closer to the European Championships, so now is as good a time as any to give the second captain's world service a try. No contract, no obligation to stay on any longer than the month you're paying for, so why not give it and us a rattle? Just check out secondcaptains.com/join. It's €5 a month plus VAT, depending on where you are in the world. And we'd love to have you. There was also a record crowd, a brilliant game, and a novel winner of the All-Ireland Camogie Final in Croker yesterday, as Galway won just their third ever title in a hugely entertaining win over Kilkenny, all coming up on today's show. But first, Simon, what part of Ireland's display on Saturday afternoon were you happiest with? Just a general improvement across the board, or were there a couple of specifics that you were particularly happy with?
Well, there was loads of improvements, but I think the fact that our halfbacks played together, were both fit, and both sort of came into form as the game went on. For the first time in what feels like ages, given both have had injuries, both had poor form for the last few months and just hadn't really played together. And like we were talking ages ago about what went wrong at previous World Cups, and one of them was both our halfbacks slipping out of form a little bit, whether it was Stringer or Agar or whoever was in there.
Yeah.
But if the two of them were playing well, like when we were considering ourselves one of the top three teams in the world before, it was always, and of course Sexton and Murray, maybe the best halfbacks in the world. If we got back to that, that fixes so many other things that look wrong. And, you know, we fixed our physicality and defence and all that sort of stuff. But if those two are playing well and fit, then we actually have a chance of a semi-final and even more.
So how come we're number one? I mean, have New Zealand not played a game in several months, or what's happening?
I mean, it does seem a little weird. I mean, when we beat them when they were world number one, we were world number two. That seemed like a more natural time for us to be world number one. Instead, we had, by any standards, a really bang average 8 months, and somehow here we are.
So you're worried that it just everyone else is laughing behind their hands at us? It's like, oh, here's the world number one.
I kind. Well, I mean, it's. I think actually, like Wales were number one like last week,
yeah.
And I think they got the brunt.
Oh, Wales were number one.
Yeah, exactly. See, Ken. This is. I knew this would happen.
Right. I just assumed that New Zealand would be number one by a distance, what with being obviously the best team in the world for years and years.
Yeah.
But now I find out it's Wales.
Yeah.
I mean, have Wales even won like the Six Nations recently?
Yeah, they won the Grand Slam. But listen, that's fine.
Oh, they won the Grand Slam this year?
They won the Grand Slam this year. They did, yeah. I mean, you would say that at least their form line is offering a few more clues as to why they might be world number one before we took over.
The previous game, I scored a new Irish record, 19 points. I was gobsmacked.
All right, we have Owen Redden and Gerry Tourney of the Irish Times ready to go. Gerry, how are you?
Good, thank you.
And Owen, how are you?
Great, very good.
Yeah, so Owen, we've had two wins in a row. Simon has just said the halfbacks are playing well, no serious injuries in four games. Schmidt is smiling. Warm-ups don't matter much, but that's the most you can hope for, particularly when you look back at how bad we were at Twickenham.
Yeah, I think you know, it looks like we're aiming. Everyone's going to the World Cup. Players, fans, coaches, everybody with you know, the right degree of optimism, probably, which would have been hard to say 2 weeks ago. And I think you couldn't argue with that. And I think the reaction of the team, of the coaches, you know, both off and on the pitch in that week would have probably shown that that wasn't acceptable. And I think they've come back well. I think to turn the ship around so quickly, you know, shows, you know, that everyone still has faith in what's going on, because it's not easy to do that, really, you know. And I think that was a big, the fact that they had that blip and turned it around a bit is actually quite promising. And I think being number one in the world is quite handy, because I think no one really believes that's true, which means you don't get the kind of, oh my God, what are we number one thoughts. But at the same time, it certainly means that you're not far away, which means it gives everybody, you know, a great confidence in a playing group that what the coach is saying works, and what my captain is saying works, and what the guy beside me doing is doing is good, and I can trust him, and I can get on with, you know, if I'm Johnny, I'm going to make sure my restarts are perfect, I'm going to kick good goals, and I'm going to run straight when I pass the ball, and I'm going to let Robbie do his bit. And I think that number one ranking kind of flows nicely into the message that Joe has been sowing for years now, which is, you know, you do your bit and we'll end up where we need to be.
One other thing that gave me encouragement was what Joe said afterwards, Owen. What he's saying was, we'd experimented a bit during the Six Nations. We wouldn't normally do that. We'd won three of the five Six Nations. We didn't need another one of those. We need a semi-final in this big competition coming up. It took some nerve, I think, for Joe after that beating by England to then go and think about the World Cup and know all the flack that might be coming his way if results and form didn't pick up in the Six Nations. Now, he still was obviously trying to win those games and do his best and use those games to develop for the World Cup, but he was sort of sacrificing the short term for the medium term of the World Cup. And maybe the most impressive bit of that is holding your nerve and accepting the criticism that might come your way in the meantime, if things do end up going well in the World Cup, that is.
Yeah, I think so. You mean for the England game?
So yeah. Henshaw, I guess, was a hint of that, first of all, that he was experimenting. Henshaw fall back. But from that point onwards, his sole focus wasn't on the Six Nations.
Yeah, and I think, you know, all of a sudden Henshaw fall back is, you know, it's not a, now it doesn't take rocket science. Now the man in the street can look at it and go, oh, okay. So Bundee Aki and Robbie Henshaw go out and have a stormer at the weekend. And, you know, Rob was at the time, you know, struggling with a hamstring injury between November and the Six Nations. And all of a sudden it's like, okay, you think back and you think, right, so I'm either going to leave Gary Ringrose off the team, or I'm going to find, you know what I mean? It even that decision is a lot clearer now. Now, as it happens, you know, Rob put probably, you know, some, I thought, really good minutes against England, actually, at the start. He looked like he was rolling back the years. And I think he was excellent at the weekend again. So it's kind of a moot point now. But, you know, that decision, even at the time, seems to be more, makes more sense as to what was going on then. You know, it was like, if I, you know, is there an option whereby if Rob breaks down before we're going to a World Cup, do we still have, you know, can we fit Gary into the team and put Robbie on? Because it's a difficult task now, fitting those three top class players into two in the middle of the field now, you know. But going back to your point, I think, you know, turning the team around and getting them, when the media, so what often happens when a team goes through a tough period is everyone is reading the papers, the media get on top of everybody, They start to drive a rift between the players and the coaches almost, because they're saying the coach is under pressure, and the players then, you know, then it's very hard to get the players to keep doing the same thing, and for them to not have different opinions about what you're saying in meetings, and for them to actually stay on task, stay on measure and deliver. Now, Joe has a lot in the tank in terms of credit, but he still had he'd lost six games in total in his tenure, what I read the other day in the paper. So, you know, losing the Six Nations games and this England game, for example, were kind of a run of results that he wasn't used to. And to me, it just says that, you know, he was well able to knuckle the team down, to pull people back in. I honestly think behind closed doors, you know, were Rory and Devon and Jacob Stockdale playing for their spots on the plane in Wales. You know, I mean, really, the performance Rory pulled out in that 20 minutes is exactly what you want from a leader who is under pressure and comes out and makes 12 tackles in 20 minutes or whatever it was. And I think where those guys like Jacob Stockdale scored an unbelievable try that kind of meant you can't leave that out, you know, turns a defensive position into a try. You know, were those guys playing for their places, and did some of them deliver, and really get that and actually play their way themselves back into, you know, and what a difference a week makes. Like Rory standing there, you know, getting the applause he deserves, but sport's not fair, and who knows how close he came to not getting that moment.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how much you would read into this Wales game, rather, judging by your comments there, quite a bit then.
I read into it a lot from when you take into context the England game. I think it sets the scene. I think if there's a fan getting on the road, on the plane in Dublin or Shannon or Belfast Airport or in Galway even on Wednesday week, you know, they're optimistic, you know, and that's, you know, really where you want everyone to be. You want the players to feel like that. You want the media like that. There is a circus to be managed here. You look at 2007 and how much of a disaster that was in terms of media messages. Like, you end up going from talking about winning World Cups to, you know, personal problems of players like being absolutely aired in public, and how that all spiraled into almost a complete another disaster, right? Where, and you see last week, you see England, handing out presents of rugby balls to fans after the game. They bring their what looks like a choreographed, player or families all out onto the pitch. You know, real feel good, real send off kind of message. You see Wales did around, you know, their counties and their clubs announcing their team, and it just felt like last week when, you know, we'd had England, we'd an okay game against Wales, and then we have this kind of rush squad announcement, which may have been down to injuries or anything more than else, and you're just wondering, Jesus, how is this all going to go? And I think it really put the pressure on the lads this weekend in terms of keeping the whole ship, and I mean everybody, I mean fans, media, everybody in the right kind of message, because unfortunately I think at a World Cup you do need everybody. You know, you'll sit in hotel rooms over there on your own with 4 hours a day free, and lads will be looking at the media and what's going on in their world will what's count. They won't be reading what the New Zealand media are saying about New Zealand, they'll be reading about what the Irish media say about Ireland, and as much as they try not to, you know, if things are kind of in the middle or going well, they probably won't, but if things had gone badly this weekend and continued into the World Cup, it's very hard to control the message and control everyone's, control all the stakeholders' kind of hopes and dreams. And I think it's as much part of the World Cup as anything else, as keeping the whole train on track.
Yeah, now that the warm-up games are out of the way, Jerry, the Twickenham game, you know, there are uses for that Twickenham hiding. Mm-hmm. Like, the expectations were so low after that now that kind of the direction that the graph is moving in is more important maybe than where we are in the graph. But because as long as that graph is moving up, then maybe fans are a bit more realistic about expectations. And we can go with a bit of confidence, but no one's really talking about the number one ranking. No one's really putting massive store on that. And there's kind of an equilibrium has been reached over the course of the four games.
Yes, far better to have lost, however horribly, to England 3 weeks ago than a week later or even last weekend in Twickenham. That wouldn't have been good at all for morale. And I think it was certainly confidence sapping, and it was wounding, and there's a sore still there that's still going to fester. That might not be any harm. You know, that might actually motivate them. It was very evident, not just in Rory Best's performance, but in the four players who were retained from the 15 that started against England. There was a Bundiaki, Peter Armani, Ian Henderson and Jacob Stockdale, how pumped up all those four were. And Stockdale spoke afterwards about using the criticism he'd received on social media to motivate him. It was very clear when he scored that first try, how he grabbed the crest. Peter O'Mahony spoke about what a long week it had been, and he was much better in Cardiff for the Irish on the pitch with number seven on his back than he had been against Twickenham. Bundy's been supercharged in the last two games, having looked a bit kind of demented almost defensively, rushing up in the Twickenham game. That Twickenham game will always puzzle me a little bit, in the sense that it certainly puzzled me at the time, because I had a bad feeling about it going into the game, because I was out in Portugal with them, and they were literally flying out of Portugal on the Thursday and almost taking the Twickenham game on the run, on the fly, as a stopover on the way to Carlton House. And it had been 8 days of hard, intensive pre-season training and getting used to those kind of climactic conditions. And they weren't primed as a team. They hadn't done a proper test match week. England had been focused on it. I'm not saying this was, you know, all part of the master plan or anything like that, but it puzzled me as to think that, where are they going with this fitness? And then even against Wales last week, and although it was a much better performance, the fact that Wales finished the game so strongly compared to Ireland kind of was still a bit... I'm thinking, look, Jason Kalman is hugely renowned for what he does, as is Kieran Ruddock, as is the coaches, as are the players themselves. And they've been having, you know, regular Pilates classes out there. And then to see them actually, as much as, almost as encouraging anything else, see the motivation over the last 2 weeks, was also to see how fit they looked on Saturday. Mm. They looked really physically collision fit. They looked super quick, a lot of them. They looked very strong, and they finished the game really strongly. And no better evidence of this than Rob Kearney. I mean, he looked about 23, not 33. The way he sprinted over the cover of the ground to prevent that try for George North, the way he came back with Robbie Henshaw to prevent Dan Biggar, and then the way he finished his try, fending off Jonathan Davies, taking that line from Johnny Sexton's pass, ending a run of 26 games out of test match. Ideal timing for him to do that. So that was all very encouraging. But most of all, it was the fitness level, how strong they looked. All along, they wanted to peak for the Scottish game in 2 weeks' time. And now, you're right, the trajectory does seem to be pointing towards that.
And Owen, I thought obviously the line-out wobbled at the start.
No bad thing, Simon. That was a good thing, almost. to have them test it, to come through that. You know, you could feel the trepidation in the ground when the first two throws went awry.
Yeah.
And it wasn't so much the throws weren't awry, it was just, you know, they were actually quite good. Particularly the second was just brilliantly picked off by Alan Wynne-Jones. And there was this murmur of discontent through the crowd, this fear. And to then win their next 10 line-outs, albeit a lot of them were to the front, was actually, it's good that they came through that test now rather than 2 weeks' time.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was going to say to you, Owen, that the line out and Sexton and the centre partnership, they all seemed to grow as the game went on. So it wasn't just that we've sort of gotten better as the four games have gone on. We got better as this final game went on. So the final 10 minutes was nearly our best 10 minutes of the whole series.
If I was to summarise the upshots of the last few months, I think, you know, I'm not sure that I'd read anything into the form for really. I think that we've kind of passed the... It's like pass or fail almost at this stage. You know what I mean? It's not like, you know, you're going to get 95 for your prep or 98 or 75. It's kind of like you're either ready and in a position where you could go and win the World Cup, or you're in a position where, you know, you're actually going to be under serious pressure, and getting out of your group is absolutely, you know, would be a huge result. So of those two positions, we're certainly in the former, which is we've passed the test. We can definitely go there with hope. And if we get everything right, who knows what will happen, right? So we're good enough. And I think that's probably the main issue. The second thing is, I think that really what's thrown up is, like, international rugby has again shown how cutthroat it is. Like, it doesn't matter if you have a game like England, and it can happen if you were a centimetre off in your prep or whatever, as Jerry just pointed out, there will be pain. And you see, you know, an absolute loved player within 2 weeks being jettisoned from a 31-man squad. And that sums up international rugby. You know, one mistake and the game is over, two or three mistakes, and honestly, you might not play again. And that is literally what's and whether they picked the right guy or not is not really my point. You know, I think the fact that message has been laid down and sent, and you know what, Joe's not the first coach to have done that. Like, Warren Gatland changed when he coached Ireland, had five changes one time when Stringer and O'Gara and all these people came in. Like, it happens, and I think that was a clear message, and I think ultimately we're going with so we've passed the hole, can we win it? And we've got great, like, for the first time ever, I'm hearing who's going to be playing the back row, who's going to be playing the centre, who's going to be playing on the wing. I mean, you could even argue who's going to be playing nine, you know, on form, not really on like over the last 3 years, but like Luke McGrath, Marmion and Murray, you know, we're all playing well. You could say they're all playing well at this stage. Marmion hasn't made it, but that's still, like, that is such a brilliant position to be in, because you do not want players wondering, will we make it out of our group? Will we make a semi-final? What you want them wondering is, will I be on this team next week? That's it. Will I get on this team next week? Peter Mahoney has a job to do now. He's got to turn up training today, and absolutely nail everything to get into this team for Scotland. And I think that is ultimately where the focus comes away from big picture. Oh my God, where are we at? What are we going to do? All the way back down to how do I get picked for this team? And that to me is the most important thing that this squad now has, that there's a level of competition that Joe can lever on and make sure that everyone is only focusing on what's in front of them and let him worry about what's happening next week.
I do think as well, Jerry, we discussed depth a couple of times in this series, but when you saw the bench that came on and just how well they played, I think we are actually at the point where we've got certainly our most explosive bench ever.
Yeah, just look at the front row alone and the carrying that Kilcoyne brings when legs are getting a little bit tired in that last 20, 30 minutes. I mean, he wouldn't be as good a defender maybe as Keane Healy or possibly even Jack McGrath, but my God, he's explosive on the ball and he's playing the best rugby of his life and he's going really well in the scrums. Sean Cronin, we all know what he can do off the bench, and Andrew Porter is a huge impact player off the bench. Then Henderson might well start the big games in time with James Ryan, but then you might have John Klein or Tadhg Byrne coming off the bench. The back row, you mentioned Reece Ruddock, how well he did. It was interesting that Josh van der Fleer went off and Ruddock assumed the number seven role, and the previous week Peter Armani assumed the seven role. Clearly Josh van der Fleer, with his ridiculous work rate, will not play all four pool games and the quarterfinals. So they've got options there at seven, and Ruddock, who's done it a few times against South Africa. I wouldn't be surprised if the Irish think tank go big in Japan when it comes to their back row, particularly if they come up against South Africa in the quarterfinals or something like that. It would seem like an obvious way to go. You've got to, you know, meet force with force. Similarly, in midfield, you've got options there, plenty. And Bundy Aki and Robbie Henshaw, to see them going so well. And they've got this telepathic understanding. Henshaw attacks the line, frees his hands. Aki's right there on his shoulder. Late in the first half, it's Aki who attacks the line, frees his hands, and it's Henshaw there on his shoulder. And that just gives them something a little bit more in midfield, maybe, with that understanding. It certainly gives them plenty of physicality. And so, yeah, you've got a huge impact on the bench there, whoever comes on. Gary Ringrose covering a few positions. I thought that was really encouraging because the Welsh bench looked quite loaded to finish the game with Dan Bigger and Liam Williams and Gareth Davis particularly there. But like I said earlier, it was just great to see. Although it was a little bit disappointing that they didn't press home their advantage against 14 men and all that set-piece dominance and the penalty count of 10-1 into a fourth try, but no harm. And I also think in all of this, they're keeping their powder a little bit dry. It was sure they went back to one-off runners and that's what they do best. And Warren Gatland, you know, not very generous in defeat against Ireland, not for the first time, suggesting that if you meet them, the one-off runners, with good line speed and tackle execution, you're disciplined and you compete well in the air, Ireland might not have anywhere else to go. I'm sure they're keeping their powder dry in some ways, like a lot of teams are.
Owen, would that be the case that Joe would think, well, certainly the game plan against Wales there in that second test would work against Scotland most likely and Japan, and then just see who you might play in the quarterfinal and not worry about those extra frills until you see who that might be? Or would Joe actually really be keeping a load of stuff behind for the World Cup?
He'll have certain things held back. I think, like, it seems to me like one of his plans was definitely, like, we didn't kick from nine for the first 2 weeks, and then we did again at the weekend. And like Gregor Townsend now, you know, has to spend at least a portion of his time, you know, in a week. Say he's got like six sessions between now and when Ireland play Scotland, and he has got to spend at least one of those maybe now, you know, contemplating that Joe might not box kick off nine because we've done it we haven't done it in two of our warm-up games. He might not really believe it, but he still has to prep. So even that small shift just gets Scotland thinking a little bit more about what we might do. And I think it's all well and good for Gatland to come at Ireland about attack, like when they don't really, they're the lowest scoring team in the Six Nations for a few years now, even though they've won it in terms of tries, and their defence is huge, and all their talk about not playing is designed for you and me to get on Joe's back, because then he goes up against Wales and he tries to play, and lo and behold, Wales' best defence, their best attacking weapon, fronts up again and knocks people over the park, because you know, 99% of people have been on their back that they're not playing any rugby, and it pops into some poor lad's head that I should play rugby today because, you know, Joe's not right all the time. And then all of a sudden, you know, Bigger intercepts the ball again and scores a try, you know. And I think, and I've been part of that message. Like, I have gone in with Wasps into games accusing teams of not playing with the whole intention that they would play so that we could mop them up, you know. And I think I actually do not believe at this point that, you know, the way the game has gone, that Ireland are attacking in any bad way. I think it is, you are going to have to front up physically to win this World Cup. There is there is no magic pill to come up with some plan that means that because you're smaller than someone you can beat them. Like, you know, size is one thing, but momentum you know, is your weight multiplied by your speed when you hit something. And the trick for Ireland is they need to be going fast. And that is where they can address the size issues. It's not about like flinging the ball around or coming up with new plans whereby you play deeper. And teams like Wales and England, who literally leave, you know, one guy at the back now. So you've got a coach with one guy at the back, like, blaming or accusing you of not playing any rugby. I mean, it's completely strategic in trying to force Joe's hand to play more against teams like England and Wales, South Africa. When in reality, you do need to muscle up. There's no other way of beating these teams. And if you need to be bigger, it just means you need to be faster. You're not going to get bigger in the next 5 weeks, but you can run faster, you can pass better, which allows people to run onto the ball harder, which allows them, you know, be a bigger man when they meet due to their speed because they meet the opposition.
Yeah, but when I think of our good line breaks over the last few games, it's say Dave Kilcoyne taking a nice angle or Ringrose cutting against the grain or Aki or Henshaw getting an offload to each other rather than our size. And people saying Stander ran over Rhys Patchell and that was maybe returned to his running form, but that was actually Patchell getting concussion. I still didn't see our big men running anybody over. Now, they may not have given too much either on the other side of it, but I still think it's smart lines and short passes and innovation that's actually creating those chances.
Absolutely, I think. But the key you mentioned there is the short passes. You know, and I don't mean you have to run straight at people. I just mean that, you know, you can take a one-out runner and you can change up onto the ball, or you can put it across the first guy and hit the second guy, or the first guy can go and go out the back to a short pass to Johnny, who can then do another kind of small play, you know. But in terms of like reinventing the wheel and being accused of not being adventurous enough, that is a play to get us all to kind of want to try things that, you know, against a team that defend like that is really a bad thing to do. You know, you have to be very tidy. Can't make mistakes. You've got to take the corners when they're available. You've got to kick really well. And you're right. Like, you do need to be, you do need lots of, you know, change ups and change of directions and small passes and deception in close. But like, you even watched New Zealand playing the Lions, what they had to revert to doing with Gatland and Edward and Andy Farrell coaching them. You know, New Zealand ended up all these plays playing off nine as well. You know, and they've got the best firepower in the world, we'd all know. So I think there is logic to the way we play. And we don't, you know, Wales's kind of secret weapon is their D. And John Edwards has saved them over the last, you know, number of years. That takes all their pressure off their attack because they get tries from their defence and they can keep people out for 15 minutes. Their maul defence is literally, I mean, I think it's the best. I can't remember a team scoring a maul try against Wales. I mean, Ireland would score maul tries for fun, and then at the weekend they're held up a few times. Now we scored eventually, but it is remarkable how good Wales' defence is, and that takes huge pressure off Gatland's attack. So he could try and play a bit more adventurously, you know, answer those critics, and then his defence kicks in and wins the game. You know, Ireland aren't in that space. We don't use our defence like that. You know, our attack play, even though it is probably, you know, it's not a wide attack play unless it's definitely on to do so. It is still our primary weapon, you know, and our discipline is our primary weapon. So I kind of agree with Gatland in that he needs to stay disciplined. But I think him kind of accusing us of not playing rugby is just the usual goading to try and get us to do something we shouldn't be doing.
If we ever meet them in the World Cup, we'd be happy if we meet them, because it'll mean a semi.
He'd be happy to see us try and play rugby against anyone and lose. Yeah. there's a real healthy competition between these coaches, you know.
Yeah, just looking at the overall selections then, Gerry, do you think that second Wales game clarified Joe's thoughts with the back row certainly and the centres, or is it literally we don't have a first choice in those areas anymore, it just depends on who we play?
I think more the latter, potentially. I think it's clear from the way that the five back rowers have been used to date, along with Tadhg Byrne, that Ireland are taking a quite flexible approach in their back row selection to the World Cup. I think it's going to be horse for courses to a degree. You know, that Scotland game, I could see Josh van der Vleer playing in that, but I'm not too sure that he might play in a quarter final against the Springboks. Along the way, you've got quite physical. The Russians are.
Just on van der Vleer, actually. Yeah. I thought he was absolutely brilliant. And I sometimes wonder, is he such an earnest, kind of team oriented man? A little bit like Robbie Henshaw, where they're just a little bit too selfless, and actually they've a few more strings to their bow that they don't always pull out. Because when Van der Vlier does carry,
they're happy in ways for the coaches to set parameters to what they can do on the field, as opposed to actually I'm better than what this game plan is asking me to do.
Yeah,
I mean, I do sometimes think that's certainly with Henshaw, but sorry, go on.
Van der Vlier carried against New Zealand, it was the same thing.
Yes, true.
And he picks an angle, and he's got pace, and he's got power, and he knows how to recycle and all that sort of stuff.
He was the most dynamic of the three back rows and carrying.
Yeah. So I'm not so sure about him not playing.
I'm not sure either. I'm just saying what I think. I think they're bringing quite a flexible approach.
Yeah.
In the sense that I think Omani at seven is an option. I think Ruddock at seven is an option, which they're going to use. And they may have well have one eye, close eye on both Russia and Samoa in rounds 3 and 4. When ideally, if Ireland, the key game is the first game against Scotland. Win that and you go into second match against Japan with going probably largely the same side again, put away the host and you're in complete control of the group, and then you can look in matches 3 and 4 with a little bit more rotation in mind, like Argentina did to us 4 years ago, and which Ireland weren't able to do because they finished up with Italy and France. So provided they beat Scotland in the opening game, which is crunch, because no, I don't think any team has ever won a World Cup after losing a match along the way. So you really would want to be winning your pool and beating Scotland for a variety of reasons, and they're tricky opponents. But come Samoa, come Russia, which will be a very big back line, they might be the most skillful side in Ireland, certainly should put them away and be able to rotate their squad heavily there. Again, against Samoa, you could play the likes of Ruddock and Chris Farrell and others and keep a lot of the frontliners back for the quarterfinal. I just think they're going to be quite flexible in the way they go about it. And if you look at the way the squad has been picked, you could almost rest nearly 14-15 players for your quarterfinal starting lineup from at least the starting team against Samoa.
From my experience with Joe, like if you're in the Scotland week, and I think it's a really important dynamic, and I'll use Wales as an example last week. So when you play, you need to know or think that this is the best team we have, and we are going all guns blazing for this match. So the Scotland team that plays will be Ireland's first choice 15. And if you deliver and play in those games, the message will be that the spot is yours, right? Until someone plays better than you in another game, or you don't play well. And, you know, you look at Wales last week, and you could have Gatland all week saying, look, this is a huge game for us, this is really important. You know, and then he calls the team out and Gareth Davies isn't playing and Dan Biggar isn't playing, and the whole team turn around and say, well, it's not that important, obviously. Okay, so this is an important thing to manage. This happened to me a few times where I played in you know, maybe 7 European Cup matches in a row, and then we'd go and play somebody and Joe would drop me for Isaac Boss in the semi-final. And, like, make no bones about it, under no circumstances was I of the opinion that I was getting rested, or that I was being saved for a Pro 14 game, or that I was going to play in the final, or any of those things. The message was, you're not picked, he's going better than you, this is the game, this is the 15 for this week, and that was the message for the whole team. So no one on that team thought anyone was getting rested or rolled or, you know. And then, you know, I did make it back for the final, and I don't know what Joe thought beforehand, but as a player, you do think whatever team is picked against Scotland, it's now yours to win or lose, you know. And I think that's the excitement of it. The guys will not be able to wait until that team is announced now, you know, and they should have that. And when they hear their name, they should know, like, this is mine and I'm going to keep this. And I think that's what you want. Like, you want people thinking about staying on this team, not thinking about huge kind of, like, winning a World Cup is a lot harder than me staying on this team, you know. And I think when people focus on staying on the team, that's when things like winning a World Cup actually happen, you know. You need proper competition, and there's no better time to do that now. So, you know, whether Joe has a plan in his head that, like you're talking about, and he's got an idea, you know, the players will certainly be of the opinion that it's mine to lose if I'm picked against Scotland. And I would agree with them. I think if a team goes out against Scotland and delivers, you know, I don't see it changing for you know, and delivers again against Japan, say, you know, and I don't see that changing for a quarterfinal, no matter who we play, you know.
Do you think Joe ever doubted himself, Owen, over the Six Nations or these warm-up games?
I think he's a person who is, you know, like most kind of elite sports people or coaches, is, you know, you judge yourself by your preparation and your work ethic. And, you know, outcomes are, you know, second, and you can't live otherwise. There's, you know, and people often, like, I'll often hear people on the radio or watching, and you might hear, you know, a sub saying, like, I really wanted my team to win when even when I wasn't playing. And, you know, you'll hear people rubbish that and say that that's just, he's lying, he's not being honest. And I've even heard ex-players saying that. But, like, there's a difference between very strong-minded individuals who can control their thoughts when, for example, the game feels like it's up and for some reason they don't think it is, or they're losing by 20 points and for some reason they think they can still win, or they're so tired that 90% of people out there would stop, but they don't stop. Or, for example, Joe, you know, should be really worried now about picking Devin Toner, because that's what 99% of the world would do. You know, Joe is more of the view of, I have done all the work, I have prepped, I've investigated, I've looked at all the stats, and I have made the best call in my own belief for what Ireland is, and he will sleep easy because of that. I won't say sleep easy, but that's where he'll go to. Like, there's a huge personal pull for him there. You know, he's got huge respect for Dev. Like, I mean, that was evident right through my career, and that was not an easy call to make. But I know that he'll be comfortable that he didn't take this decision lightly, that he didn't leave any stone unturned. And it's not what 90% of the public would do or feel, but that's life. That's why he's where he is. And that's why the players are where they are as well.
All right, really interesting. That's whetted the appetite nicely. Great stuff, unridden. Gerry Thorney, the next time we speak to you, Gerry, you're going to be in, you're flying out to Japan on Friday.
Friday, right?
Well, next time we speak to you, it'll be from Japan. It's all getting very close now. Thanks so many for joining us.
Cheers.
Surtout pas d'être pris hors jeu, pas hors jeu, pas hors jeu. Tant pis, ça on s'est du terrain. Mais
attention, jeu. Le drop, il arrive. Le drop de Jonathan Sexton.
Le drop.
C'est terrible, terrible.
Jonathan Sexton à l'interrompt. On crucifie l'équipe de France.
France have been absolutely destroyed. Absolutely destroyed.
Available for Murray. Moves it back down now towards CJ Stander. CJ Stander under pressure, but it's Ireland to have control of it. Midway between the French 22 and the 10-metre line. Sexton with the attempted drop of goal. Goal side the 22.
Goes towards the post. It's gone towards the post. It's over. Ireland with the drop of goal. It's gone between the posts. Late drop. The ball is gone. The fellas are just literally on top of each other. Away to the left hand side. France have been absolutely destroyed with the final kick of the game. A drop and goal. France have been robbed of victory. 83 minutes gone. After Stade de France, the pace has gone mad. Ireland have snatched it from the jaws of defeat.
Incroyable. Quel match winner. Quel match winner.
Jonathan Sexton à la dernière seconde crucifie l'équipe de France. Que c'est dur. C'est terrible. Terrible. Le drop de Jonathan Sexton.
Our first game in the Rugby World Cup is on Sunday the 22nd of September at 9:15 against Scotland. Yes, that is 9:15 on a Sunday morning, but that's fine. We can still be excited about it. And between the jigs and the reels, we're going to get there in pretty good shape. Now, just talking about the line-out and talking about
how they fixed it as the game went on.
Yeah. Like, it struck me watching that James Ryan just took it upon himself to say, this is my line-out. There is no Devin Toner parachute. It's on me to fix it.
Yeah.
And rightly or wrongly, it's now my line-out, so I don't have a fallback. There is no plan B. And they got there. And I just kind of felt that, like, say, in the Twickenham game, the Toner parachute was still absolutely there. Yep. He was on the bench that day. Mm. Came on. So
it didn't fix it.
It didn't fix it. Mm. And, you know, maybe that's a part of James Ryan taking responsibility as well. It's like, if the parachute was still there, it still might not fix it come the World Cup. So I have to make this work. And if, you know, we've seen one thing from James Ryan over the course of his rugby career over the last 18 months or 2 years, is that he's a pretty unflappable guy. Like, he does not get panicked.
Yeah.
And that in a situation like this, rather than a leadership position, you know, daunting. Weighing on him or daunting on him, he grows with it. He absolutely embraces the challenge. I think that alone, given the fact that we lost those two lineouts, as Gerry was saying, maybe not a bad thing to have the pressure put on you and actually respond and have the lineout go as well as it did in the last.
And this was the one thing we don't know about James Ryan yet, or maybe we didn't until the weekend, was the cerebral side of the game. And I think you're right, it wasn't just James Ryan. Rory Best and Sean Cronin also know that Devin Toner isn't coming on or won't start the next game. So it's in their heads to either get these throws right and these calls right in the next few minutes, or this is a horrible World Cup. Like, if the line-out completely goes, it doesn't matter what the rest of the game is like, it's going to be a shocking World Cup. And even with Cronin, I thought Cronin threw better than he ever has done for Ireland. Like, the speed, trajectory, the calls, they all suit him. So the second the fours arrived, he is the call. He throws in at pace. And that might actually even suit his personality too, in that he doesn't have to dwell on it for too long. Say like a golfer hovering over a putt or even a place kicker in rugby. You know, you sort of want to decide what you want to do and then just do it. But yeah, for Cronin, Best, James Ryan, Henderson and all the guys who worked out the lineup, very encouraging.
Right, Galway are the new All-Ireland Senior Camogie Champions after they won the best Camogie final in years yesterday. Three first-half goals did the business for them for only their third ever All-Ireland title. Sinead O'Carroll of thejournal.ie was in Crooker yesterday and she's in studio right now. Sinead, how are you?
How are you? I just realised it's Galway, so it's your Galway.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, I think when I'm sitting in this seat, they have to be a they as opposed to a we. I mean, I that's just a rule that I basically invented this second, but this was the best final in years, wasn't it?
Oh yeah, like I was still buzzing when I woke up this morning because I think all of us who play Camogie and who love Camogie really wanted that this weekend. We really wanted it to be, to do justice to the game, to do justice to the abilities that we know that the players have, particularly in these two teams. Like we've seen Kilkenny over the last couple of years play defensively. You know, that's how Cork set up. So sometimes when, you know, one team set up it with a sweeper, that's how the other team end up kind of mirroring them. Or
and they end up spending a lot of the season beforehand preparing to play that team. So they, you know, they're trialing sweepers in games that they wouldn't. And then all of a sudden they're the sweeper team.
Yeah. And to win in All-Ireland, you had to beat a Cork Camogie team. So that they become kind of the behemoth you have to get over. And I don't think we probably realised it enough over the last couple of years that was the issue. I think we blamed rules and we blamed referees, and there's definitely some portion of blame to be apportioned to that as well. But just, we were just going into yesterday just begging for a good match, and like, whoa, did they deliver? And like, that was on the back of, you know, a really good semi-final between Galway and Cork as well.
That was shown live on television as well.
Yeah, and you know, there was 25,000 people there. That was the aim. That's, you know, that's the most we've got at a standalone. So there wasn't an under 21 hurling final attached to it. So yeah, waking up this morning and knowing that like so many people know who Niamh Kilkenny is now, like you know, that's like, that's something that's really important for me when I'm kind of looking at the media kind of landscape of how women in sport is covered. Like today, people were just talking about the match instead of like kind of the wider concept of, you know, we should be supporting women playing sport. You're like, no, there's actually enough to talk about, you know?
Yeah, there's enough going on. Now, we say Kilkenny weren't playing with a sweeper yesterday. They probably could have done with it in the first half, to be honest. I mean, like the three goals that Galway got, they were ripped apart.
Yeah, the first 10 minutes. And actually, it was even at half time, a lot of the issues in the Kilkenny full back line had been shored up, but the damage was done, you know. Obviously, the last goal went in as well. But, you know, there had been some good defensive play in the middle part of the first half. But just those first couple of goals, they were ripped apart. But the cornerbacks got turned very easily, which was like Colette Dormer, really, really experienced. Like she got turned twice in a really uncharacteristic way. And Downey talked afterwards about maybe there was a bit of fear, you know, that fear of losing the three in a row. And, you know, and that's, it's not just about the three in a row for that Kilkenny team. It's like they've lost 8 of the last 9 finals they've been in going back to, I think, 2008. So, you know, that might have been the case. Edwina Keane got taken off within the first half. So that was a real problem area for Kilkenny. Mm-hmm. And then Ailish O'Reilly and Niamh Hanafy, Ailish O'Reilly in particular in the first half, she went, I was reading this morning on the 42, like she went down with the thing of, we're going to score goals, Niamh, you know, club mates, you know, this is what our job is today. We get the goals, we win. And that was the difference, I think, in the end, when Kilkenny should have been going for goals in the second half, they weren't. So in the first half, like Ailish O'Reilly just absolutely ripped them apart. But with Niamh Kilkenny, obviously, the assist as well.
Yeah, so you've mentioned her twice already there. And she was sensational, scoring 4 points from midfield. You know, player of the match by a country mile. And again, like this was her sixth All-Ireland final And she played like a woman who really did not want to have a record of played six, lost five, and won just the one.
Yeah, and actually it was she was superb, but also Aoife Donoghue as her midfield running mate was also superb. So they did actually, you know, that phrase of like the engine of the team, they just looked like that at every second. Like Aoife Donoghue is a really like small in stature person and she does not play like that at all. Like she plays with as much power and feistiness as like anyone else of like who will overcome her in size. But the two of them together were just relentless, and it really, like, going back to what you were saying about maybe they needed that sweeper system, you know, because they were just ripping through.
I mean, the game plan was not overly complicated. It was poke the ball down into the sort of the Kilkenny centre back region, and then just the two goalie midfielders just absolutely like clearing that entire area, picking up an ocean of breaking ball. And then when you pick up breaking ball that close to the opposition goal, I mean, you know, you talked about the Kilkenny full back line. I mean, there's not a lot you can do when you're getting beaten as comprehensively as that in that area of the field.
And all the balls were being picked up at pace. That was one of the big things I noticed the difference of between last year and this year. Every single time that a ball was being passed, it was being taken at pace. Mm. There was no slowing down at all of the ball. But going back to the puck out, Sarah Healy's puck outs were going up to the 45 on the other side. Like they were absolutely humongous, and they were consistently humongous. We used to play Camogie on a small pitch with small goals, 12 aside. Yeah. Like Sarah Healy wouldn't have been able to put the ball in.
She'd been top scorer 15 years ago. Yeah.
Would have been too far. So like when you think about that, like I'm 34 and like I played the game as a 12 aside, you know, so it's not that long since the game has shifted from that. So that's phenomenal that she is. And that was a big difference. Like Emma Cavan is a really small goalkeeper as well. So maybe her power won't be as well, but that 20-30 yards was making a big difference. They were all going to the half back line or the Galway half forward line, which was just creating so much danger every single time for Kilkenny.
Yeah, I mean, Galway, and again, you'd references already, but they beat Cork, the reigning All-Ireland champions, in the semi-final, beat Kilkenny in the league final this year, and obviously in the game yesterday. So this is an All-Ireland that brooks no argument whatsoever from Galway's point of view. But it is hard to escape that Kilkenny is kind of the story here as well. Like, the idea that you lose three All-Ireland finals in a row means the sort of thing that can destroy teams. And actually, you referenced the quotes from Anne Downey after the game. Maybe because they haven't been here for so long, Kilkenny have been here for the last few years, maybe our players were just so afraid of losing they weren't able to express themselves. And, you know, maybe we've lost so many All-Irelands that fear was holding our girls back. Some of the young girls played with freedom. Maybe some of the older girls know that the end of the line is nearer this year than it was last year. Maybe that does hold them back, but I couldn't ask any more of them. I read that and I thought, oh my God, either you're going to go or half the team is going to be cleared out. So she's announced today that she's stepping down. Yeah. So maybe no surprise when you see a quote like that.
Yeah, and she came back in 2016 and, you know, ended the 22-year famine. So I don't think there's probably fault to her, and she has been good at bringing good people in alongside her. So I don't necessarily think she had to go, but it probably will be nice for them to have new blood and just to have none of that hanging over them.
Yeah, I don't think, you know, I wasn't suggesting that she had done anything wrong. I mean, I think everyone knows the job that she did was really good. It's actually just like, okay, the well is kind of poisoned.
Yeah,
here now,
I think
you know,
that's
when
it.
You've
it's
had
like,
that many bad defeats.
It's another decision that she's made for the benefit. She's like, well, actually, we can benefit from this. If I go and the girls feel like there's a change next year, that it's not the same thing. I was really struck by Noelle Healy after Dublin eventually won, after losing I think they were three in a row that they had lost as well. She was saying, you know, putting the gear back in the shed after getting off the bus, after losing All-Ireland final, like, it actually makes me almost well up because it's so overwhelming, that feeling of just losing constantly and consistently. So Kilkenny have to take lessons from those teams that have managed to do it, that they can, like, they have fantastic players. And going back to what happened yesterday, like, they stuck with them. They got to within 2 points. Mm. Like, you know, there was a time, like, and Malachy Clerken wrote this in his piece for the Irish Times yesterday as well. Like, at halftime, it was like, Galway were fantastic. They completely ripped open their defence. But Kilkenny are still there. They're not completely out of it. And, you know, they did, you know, tack on a lot of points in the second half, played well. It wasn't like this was all just the Galway show. You know, they did have chances. And I think why I read into that fear thing was that there just seemed to be, it didn't look like patience. You know, with some teams who are really experienced, it looks like, we can just tick off these points, this is fine, like, just keep ticking along with the points and eventually everything will get back to equilibrium and then we can kick on. They just never look like, I think Miriam Walsh never looked like she was going to make the break in full forward. She had a chance, she could have gone for a goal. Denise Gall the same. Anne Dalton, who was just a shadow of her usual self. We had one moment of magic from her where she bounced the ball off the ground, got it back into her and hit off her left and put it over. But she had another chance that, you know, if she had gone, there might have been a goal. I think a goal would have sparked Kilkenny maybe a little bit more in the second half. It just wasn't happening for them at that level. But it's not like they were playing terribly. Mm-hmm. Like they were still
the
in
middle,
it. Like,
the middle half of the second half. So they didn't start all that great, but the middle half of the second half, it actually looked like that bit of experience was going to tell for them.
Exactly.
And that's when, you know, Niamh Kilkenny actually won this game by herself. I mean, she got her third and fourth point were the last 2 points of the game, or they're two of the last 3 points of the game. I mean, she won the game.
Decisive. It moved it from being from 2 points to 3 point lead and the 5 point to the 6 point lead. So she'd kind of moved the needle and made sure this is shored up. This is ours. Like, you know, there's
there,
no
there are times in every game when you look to the best players on your team to just go and do something and, you know, go and win the game. And that's what she did, you know, which is kind of what legends are made of, I suppose. But another thing that you referenced earlier was the refereeing. And it was a lot more lenient, or it appeared to me to be a lot more lenient yesterday than it had been for the last number of years in All-Ireland finals. How much of an issue has the refereeing of the game been in recent years? Because I've seen basically every single interview with a Camogie player in the last 3 years. They've been talking about allowing greater physicality in the game. Ref it with an understanding that we're putting all of this effort into physical training, we're getting ourselves into brilliant shape, we want to be able to use that.
Yeah, and did you see the girls yesterday? They were in incredible shape, like completely. You can see how much strength and conditioning is going on.
Yeah, and Gola have a dedicated strength and conditioning coach.
It's more the rules rather than the referee. It's a bit of both. So there's the program yesterday had a guide for people to let you know what the difference is in rules between hurling and camogie are. A lot of camogie players want gone, like, you know, we're allowed hand pass a goal, which if you're a cornerback, fullback or goalie, you definitely want gone. But even if you're a forward, like, most of them don't feel like that's a skill that they should be allowed to utilise. It's gone from hurling, it should be gone from camogie. We're allowed to drop the hurl when we're hand passing. That also seems kind of silly, like we're able to hand pass with the hurl still in our hand. So there's some things like that. The physicality rule is you're not allowed to deliberately shoulder the player without going for the ball. So in hurling, you'll see a shoulder and then someone go for the ball. In camogie, you are meant to be allowed to shoulder each other as long as there's also an attempt to go for the ball. So that context allowed. That's where the refereeing probably went into the grey area, where some people would blow up every single time you had any contact with another player. Other times, referees would be more lenient. So yesterday, Ray Kelly, the ref from Kildare, would have been known over the summer. Actually, a lot of refs over the summer, because they were taking on board what players were saying, what people were saying the sport needs, and taking on board the actual rules around contact, that there has been a lot more free-flowing games. That they, like, the last couple were just free-taking competitions. And even the last free that Cork won last year was a really dubious one. It was
very soft. Yeah.
Very, very soft. And, you know, that's bad for the sport. It's bad for the spectator. Why would you go, like, you know, as someone who really tries to get people to become interested in camogie, because I think it's worth being interested in, that's a hard one to debate then last year, because you're like, oh, that wasn't really good enough to back up my arguments.
Yeah, and it's like it becomes a rather deeper argument than whether you like the sport or don't, if, you know, everyone playing the game has a major problem with the rules as they're being as they're being refereed, you know, like but oftentimes you actually see that the game changes before the rules change.
Exactly. You know, which has happened here,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, and I know that there is a Congress coming up in the next couple of months, and I think that, you know, whatever rule changes, I mean, particularly on the, and again, this is why yesterday is so important. I mean, we don't want to be talking about, you know, it as an event. You want to be talking about it as a sporting contest. But that's, again, why a good All-Ireland final is so important, because it sets like if the All-Ireland football final had been terrible, then all the rule changes that we saw in the league this year, you know, that would be rearing its ugly head as well. So
yeah, we're not talking about this just as a women's sport issue. This is like a sport issue in general. I think this final will really help the rule review and any motions that might be a bit pernickety for people to pass. I think there is some traditionalists who don't like the idea of more contact coming into the game, whereas Sunday you're just like, well, it's there, you know it is there, and it makes for a better contest. Like, you know, no one is getting hurt, nobody, it's not taking away from the skill level of the game, it's actually only adding to it. I did think Ray Kelly did a great job. It was kind of funny at one point, the Galway fans were booing him because it had been a while since Galway had got a free, but I think they can't have argued with any of the frees that had been given against them in the first half, because, you know, Sarah Dervin was, you know, kind of
treading a fine line.
She was treading a fine line, and she did really well not to get the second yellow at some stage, and to keep Kilkenny scoreless at fullback. You know, we were saying at halftime, God, if she lasts without a second yellow and Galway winning All Ireland, that's some good going. But at one stage the Galway fans started booing Ray Kelly, and I was like, no, we've been begging for this kind of refereeing for years. Be quiet. I think it was a good departure, a good change, and fair play to the association for listening and taking some of that on board.
Shane O'Carroll of thejournal.ie, thanks a million for coming in.
Thanks a million.
Words alone are not enough. I have to resort to song.
Oh, well, yeah, okay.
A heart full of love, a heart full of song. I'm doing everything all wrong. Oh, God, for shame, I do not even know your name. Dear World Service subscriber, won't you say?
Ken Early, Owen McDevitt, secondcamps.com. Go on and subscribe if you're not already a member. Great value for money. Better value for money than the license fee, some people would say, Alan. Not me now, obviously, but
not me either.
I don't want to put them down, but they seem to want to prove that you don't need to know anything about football to write about it.
What you think doesn't really matter.
The press come and go, as we know. You mentioned Ken Early. Well, yeah. You know, I wouldn't necessarily agree with anything Ken Early says about football.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
Bang up to date now with My Sad Captains, not to be confused with Second Captains, the equally brilliant Second Captains. It's My Sad Captains.
Okay, that's pretty much it for us today. We'd like to thank you as ever for listening. Thank you, Ken.
Thank you, Kieran.
Thank you, Simon.
Thank you, Kieran. Thank you, Simon.
And we'll chat to you tomorrow.
What form is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
Those boys.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.